Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 35, the brain-machine interface. Futures in Biotech is brought to you by GoToMeeting. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark. Years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. I wanted to start this week's episode by talking a little bit about some of the embarrassing moments that I've had while recording Futures in Biotech. Now, there's two in particular that come to mind. The first one is when I asked Harrison Schmidt, who was the lunar module pilot for Apollo 17, whether or not living and working on the moon for 3 days was like camping. That one was pretty bad. But the second one is more relevant to today's show. And that's when I asked Eric Kandel, he was the Nobel laureate for physiology or medicine in 2000 for his work on memory. I asked him whether or not there would come a time when we could interface directly with the human brain with a jack, sort of like a USB plug, whereby we could perhaps learn how to fly a helicopter or martial arts. And I, of course, took that from The Matrix. Well, our guest today is doing something very similar to this, so I guess it's not that embarrassing to ask that sort of question. His name is Dr. Justin Sanchez, and he's the director of the Neuroprosthetics Research Group at the University of Florida. He's also an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics, Division of Neurology, and in the Department of Neuroscience, and also the Department of Biomedical Engineering. So I direct the question to him.
Yeah, so I think I can definitely answer that question. So Kandel didn't answer it, or he didn't understand it?
Well, he picked up on it, because I guess nobody had ever asked him, when are we going to be able to plug in an interface into our head, right? A parallel interface or right. Universal serial bus. So you're one of the few guys that's sort of bringing this together. So
yeah, we're doing this.
You know, tell us your story. How do you get started on this? And then what is it about?
Yeah. So we're developing these new devices that are really similar to the idea of the bionic man. In the old TV show that a lot of us used to watch, it was more for enhancing performance and an individual's ability. The premise behind what we're really doing, though, is trying to develop new therapies for patients that are disabled. So you can imagine that if you have, sustained a spinal cord injury and you become paralyzed, let's say from the neck down, and you've lost control of your arms, we would like to develop this prosthetic device that we could implant into your brain, and it would translate the signals that are coming out of your brain. So just to put in general terms, it would translate your thoughts and your intent to move, and we could use this prosthetic device to control a robotic arm or a computer directly from your brain. So, and that, yeah, go ahead.
A brain prosthetic, right?
That's exactly right. So what we're basically doing is we're bypassing the injury in your spinal cord, and we're using engineering and technology and computers to translate your thoughts and use it to express your intent.
This is the most, probably one of the most difficult projects. Maybe that's why I'm hesitant. You're interfacing, right? You're not going from a neuron that's in your arm that's gone through your central nervous system and the spinal cord. You're tapping right into the brain.
That's right. You're tapping into the primary or executive control command center, of your brain. And the first major challenge is, what signals should you be looking at, and how do you acquire those signals?
How do you interface? What's that primary biological mechanosensory whatever connection? How do you do that?
Yeah. So we use electrophysiology. So electrophysiology has been around for many years. I think one of the first instances of this was around the 1920s, where it really became popular. So what we do is we place these fine microwires. They're about the diameter of a hair, around 50 microns. And we build an array of these, a two- or three-dimensional array. So you have this kind of grid of electrodes, and then we slowly insert them into the brain tissue and slide these minuscule electrodes right next to the cell bodies of neurons that are of interest to us.
Does that hurt?
So in the... Right. So you can't feel pain in the brain, right? You have no pain receptors there. So from all the studies that are out there, I don't think anybody has felt pain. But it's a very interesting concept, though, right?
Dr. Penfield from Montreal back in the 50s was doing open skull surgeries to resect the brain, right? Removing parts of the brain to
that's right.
Prevent epilepsy.
Yeah, for epileptic patients.
That was in our last mm-hmm. show. So I guess you don't really feel it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that you would feel it. So we work with some epileptic patients in our laboratory. We've had some of them control prosthetic devices with the exact same type of electrodes that Penfield used so many years ago. The only instances where they can feel some kind of sensation is if you stimulate through some sensory or motor cortices, and you see some sort of physical response from that stimulation. And I have some really interesting videos of some patients who have had some evoked responses from stimulation of that type.
If these are available, I'd love to link to them.
Sure.
How's that electrophysiological process? How does it go from synapse to electrophysiological probe? What is the chemical? Do you mind? I guess we can get pretty technical
here. Yeah, sure.
The audience is pretty...
Right, but I can go in general terms here. So we can think of these microelectrode arrays as an antenna array that is just sitting in the extracellular space in the brain. And it's seeking to sense changes in ionic concentrations in that space. So whenever you have any individual neuron depolarize... it will exchange some ions into that extracellular space. And basically what these microelectrodes are doing are sensing that change in concentration and referring it to some ground location. So whenever these neurons depolarize, we can see that change in ionic concentration. We can actually measure individual action potentials from all of the neurons in the vicinity of those electrode arrays.
There must be quite a few. And before I go on to how many are there, how do you ground an individual? Is this going to be grounded to a? Does it have to be grounded to a structure? Can it be to your belt
yeah,
buckle?
So so the type of grounding that you use usually depends upon what type of electrophysiology you're doing. So for these types of microelectrodes, we will ground to the skull or to some surface electrode that's right on the very surface of the brain. If you use some modality like EEG, for example, you could ground to somewhere like the ear or some other part of the body. So you really just need a differential type of signal through which you can sense these change in ionic concentrations.
How many probes do you require?
Yeah, so since we're very interested in recording single neurons, we typically say how many single neurons are necessary for decoding a patient's intent. So there are many, many, many more neurons in the brain compared to the ones that we can sense. So let me just give you some reference for the numbers. Let's say we put 100 electrodes into the brain. Approximately 60 or 70% of those electrodes will yield single neurons that we can discriminate. Okay, so, and for each one of the electrodes that we record from, we can typically sample between 2 and 3 individual neurons. So that just gives you some scale for, let's say, 100 electrodes if you were to implant them. It's not uncommon to implant hundreds of electrodes into the brain of either an animal or a human. So we're on the order of, let's say, between 40 or 50 neurons and several hundred neurons that we can tap into simultaneously.
Is that enough to get intent?
Right. So there have been a lot of studies that have been out there over the last, let's say, 10 years that have showed that you can decode a person's intent to move their arm with very precise resolution with only a handful of neurons. And it's quite interesting when we think about this, because from a technical point of view, a scientist may say, well, yeah, I'm extremely lucky. I've placed these electrodes in the brain so precisely that I've gotten exactly the information that I need. I tend to take the opposite perspective. I think that there is so much redundancy in these systems that we're trying to probe that even by chance putting in these electrodes, even remotely in the vicinity of the right areas, we can extract the information that we need. So I don't think it's any luck that we're getting the relevant information from only a handful of neurons.
Is it a process malleable in terms of the biology? Will a person be able to develop the correct synapses around the array to be able to learn how to manipulate?
Yeah, so over these last 10 years that I've been referring to, it's basically shown proof of concept that an individual can control a device directly from the signals from their motor cortex, for example. We're only now just starting to get into an area of neuroprosthetic or brain-machine interface research where we're trying to study how does the neurophysiology change as an individual is using this type of device. So throughout our lives, we're encountering new experiences, we are changing our perspective of the world, and that is really represented by the activity of these neurons in the brain. So we should expect that by interacting with an artificial interface, that process will also happen. And again, it's very exciting right now because we're just being able to study these large populations of neurons in conjunction with use of this artificial prosthetic.
Is it a permanent installation? So if you're paralyzed and you decide to go ahead with this form of therapy, do you see it as being a permanent structure that gets inserted inside the skull, and then as we were kind of joking around before with a serial bus. it's so fantastic. I mean, this is the stuff of science fiction, absolutely. So would you see that kind of installation permanent in the brain? I mean, you can't keep going in, you can't. These things can't be adjusted too many times. I guess you don't have access to the human brain as often as you know you want. It's not like changing a
light bulb.
Yeah. I hate to say it.
So, so exactly. I think at least my vision for the future is to implant one of these devices into the brain. You would have a microchip, a fully self-contained, rechargeable type of microchip that has a wireless telemetry on it, and you would implant it underneath the scalp and through the skull and directly into the brain tissue, and you would leave it there, and you would want it to work for tens of years. We're actually working on one of these devices right now here at the University of Florida. We have a large NIH grant to actually build one of these devices. And to give it some scale, it's roughly the size of the area of a quarter, a U.S. quarter. And it will be a fully contained device as electrodes and wireless telemetry and battery power. So
of course, once you implant,
of course,
I'm so 90s,
right? So the studies that we actually do now with animals and even humans have wired types of communication systems, and of course, that's not really feasible for the activities of daily life. So again, the vision for the future is to have these devices implanted into the brains of individuals who are disabled. And you will not be able to tell that they actually have an implant, right? We're going to be streaming this data out of their brain and sending it to whatever thought translation device that we would have that would interpret their intent and use it to control a prosthetic device. Now, you also asked about this idea of, can you move it around? How would this really work in? So right now, all of the designs, you target a location in the brain and you will implant this entire device at that location. The only amount of movement that would be possible with the current technology is that you could possibly change the depth of the electrodes as they're inserted into the brain. So let's say you wanted to fine-tune into a specific group or population of neurons that were really relevant for you. There are some motorized types of devices that can move the positions of these microelectrodes.
Wow, so you could actually go fish a more precise...
That's exactly right.
Signal.
Tune in to the right neurons. That's right.
Tune into the brain. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, so you're basically right now working on animals and that transition and some humans? Are you transitioning?
That's right. So, yeah.
You have some wireless mouse. You have a wireless mouse.
Competing with Microsoft.
So there are some wireless rats that are out there, but we primarily do a lot of the technology development and prototyping in rat models.
Okay.
We dream up these great dreams of how technology is going to be in the future, and then we bring them to life on the electronics workbench, and then we transition them into some animal studies that really show proof of concept and feasibility. And then, so my position right now at the University of Florida is quite interesting. My PhD is actually in biomedical engineering, but I work in a clinical department. I work in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Neurology. And the main reason for doing that was I wanted to create an environment where we have a direct path to translate these great new enabling technologies from the animal lab and the electronic workbench directly into the patient's room, the patient's bedroom there. And by working closely with clinicians, we are doing that. So we have undergone a few clinical studies with some patients where they have had electrodes implanted into their brain, and we've had them control computer cursors just with their thought.
So this is not teleportation. What do you call it? Telekinesis, right? By the fact, especially that you're going wireless, what couldn't you control?
Right. So there are a whole host of devices. When you actually think about if you engineer a new communication device. I think that we're only limited by the signals that we can capture from the brain, right? I typically think of biology as a robust type of communication channel, but it's typically very slow compared to the types of communication channels that we have in our current, say, computers or cell phone type of communication devices. So, it may be even possible to scale a person's abilities if you communicate through these types of engineered devices.
So you could have added us where you have a fighter pilot just thinking about controlling his flying, you know,
that's right.
Flight controls, and then he can work on navigation or some other kind of task with his hands. I guess he could be thinking, oh, I feel like moving left, and then ailerons swing over and... It just opens up so many possibilities of using our mind to control devices. Not to mention, I mean, the huge biology and medical evolution. This is evolutionary. It's not revolution. It's revolutionary. It's not evolutionary. We should continue a little bit about the process of your work on rats, so that we have it's concrete. I mean, you know, as a listener here, and I consider myself a listener, is that is it tangible, right?
That's right.
And in your lab, you're sticking electrodes and doing surgeries probably multiple times a week and seeing animals behave and control devices. And this is so far ahead in time for me. I guess I'm an old timer. I think of a wireless mouse, you know, in a whole new new way, and this is a wireless rat. Are you working with paraplegic rats? Are you causing spinal cord injury in rats and seeing if they can then start to move devices? Or can you then resend the signal back into the appendages, back past the spinal cord? Is this an input-output device back into neurons?
To answer your first question, we all have able-bodied rats right now, but there's an interesting story around the able-bodied rats. So we performed the stereotaxic neurosurgery in my laboratory. We placed these electrodes in the brains of these animals, and then we put them into a behavioral experiment where they have to control a robotic arm in order to get some water. Okay, so they have to navigate this robotic arm directly with their neural activity, and when that robotic arm gets to one of a set of targets that we cue them on, they will get a reward back. Now, what's quite interesting is that when you first put the animal into this behavioral experiment, they try to still move their own appendages to influence the robotic arm. Now, of course, in this experimental paradigm, no amount of movement on their part will control that robotic arm. And then rather quickly, let's say even within one recording session over, say, a couple hours, they will learn that they can stop moving and rely solely on their neural activity alone to control that robotic arm. So it appears that the switch from physical movements to brain control of a device is very seamless, even in lower animals such as rats. So it's really, really interesting that that an individual will really learn to rely just upon this direct neural activation instead of their own physical behaviors.
That's pretty amazing that
and this, so to them it's not I guess there's a learning aspect to it, but they have no fear of no resistance to just simply using their mind.
That's pretty neat. That's exactly right. So I think rats are extremely clever, opportunistic type of of creatures, and they will do they'll exert the minimal amount of effort to get what they want back from the world. And in this case, it turns out that using their brain activity to control the device to get water rewards is actually easier than them physically moving. So I think that if a rat can learn that relationship, the possibilities for humans are quite tremendous.
So how technical is this? How long does it take to do the surgery? So you have a little saw, you go into the skull, the animal's anesthetized. The sleep.
Yeah. So we do, as I said before, the stereotaxic neurosurgery. So the process is quite technical and takes a lot of skill and precision. This type of stereotaxic neurosurgery is also used on humans who have surgery on their brain. And essentially what it does is that we create a coordinate system in the rat's head so that we can precisely target specific structures within their brain. And once this coordinate system has been made, we move the electrodes to the appropriate location and then slowly drive them through a very small hole, what we call a burr hole or a craniotomy, and insert these electrodes. So just to give you some scale on what it takes to do this, if you, let's say, want to put in 100 electrodes, it can easily take several hours. Procedure to place these electrodes.
Where did you learn this? This is not an easy skill to acquire. I suppose neurosurgery residency, but your training is a PhD in biomedical engineering.
In biomedical engineering, yeah. So I worked during my PhD with one of the pioneers of brain machine interfaces. His name is Miguel Nicolelis at Duke University. So he was one of the people who have shown tremendous advancements in this area and the ability to control devices. The idea of stereotaxic neurosurgery and placing in microelectrodes or arrays of microelectrodes has been around for quite a long time, and it's been perfected over the last 15 or 20 years. So it's working with great people who have great technique, and we really pass along the experience. It's kind of like learning, a very skilled type of art form. So it's tremendous.
You must have a really good pair of hands too. I mean, you need.
Yes, keep those steady hands and keep a cool temper.
Well, with rats, what's your success rate? You know, you miss one and that becomes, you know, python food. You can just
right, so,
your pet snake. But so
in all of my experience, I've never had a rat that did not have useful neural signals that we could use to control a prosthetic device.
Fantastic.
And again, I think this comes back to the amount of redundancy that's in these neural circuits in the brain. I don't think that this result is luck. I think it's the physiology which helps us to be so successful.
When I guess people first started to think about inserting a valve inside a heart, that must have been tremendously scary. You know, a mechanical valve just mm-hmm. to assist in pumping inside the heart. So you open the heart and they insert this device that they could have failure. And that's that mental hurdle into the process of surgery, I guess, could be overcome pretty quickly too when people see how amazing it would be to have a device that allows them to be telekinetic. For someone who has a severe disability, I mean, it would be so great. Not only would they become mobile with some bionics, without cumbersome cables and packs, they could do things that are superhuman.
Yeah, there's a nice analogy, and I often tell the story also in some of the talks that I give. And back in the cardiac pacemaker days, this in the 1960s, it was a revolutionary idea that we could put these little electrical leads in the heart and really bring back life to those who are suffering from some sort of heart disease. You stimulate the heart when you need it, and it really opens up a whole new perspective. And it was revolutionary and quite shocking. People say, "Oh, you're putting these machines into
no
the heart.
Pun intended.
You know, what are you doing?" That's right. What are you doing to these individuals? Are you making them less human? And I think the benefits of such technology, right, are so great that today millions of pacemakers are inserted into the hearts of humans, and it's a common idea now, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that we're at a crossroads like that with direct neural interfaces for the brain. Right now, it seems so futuristic, but the potential benefits for helping humanity are so great that the technology is absolutely necessary to be developed. And once we start realizing these benefits in many humans, I think it will become a common scenario.
Well, isn't there two major issues that affect human health? I mean, there's three. I would say genetic disease, which is predetermined. You can try and develop a therapy for it. Two, there is disease that happens without your control, infectious disease, and you can try and tackle that. But then there's injury, and that whole level of medicine where you're trying to recover and reinstate somebody's quality of life is a tremendous field, right? Because it's the third wing in my opinion of medicine. Although mm-hmm. I guess my view of medicine is somewhat of an oversimplification, but if this could be the last, well, not the last frontier, but an important frontier. But here's the big segue. You were saying that the pacemaker was able to add current at the right times and regulate heart to restore heart function. That's an output device, right? Can we
right.
can we go about can your electrode will your electrode detect the changes of ions and hence conductivity in the brain, translate that to a signal that a computer can respond to? Can you send the signal the other way? Can you trigger a synapse?
Right. So we think of these systems as closed loop types of devices. And the types of communication that we've been discussing so far has just been in the realm of signal translation. So these neurons change their firing properties. You have in a computer which translates this activity and then does something useful with it. There are studies that are ongoing right now that are trying to send information back into the brain via the concept of electrical stimulation. So if you send a little bit of current into different parts of the brain, you may be able to excite neurons and change the firing properties of these ensembles or neural networks. One of the most obvious implementations of these are for retinal types of prosthetics or cochlear implants, where you're trying to restore sight or hearing in an individual, right? You are sensing something back from the environment of the world, and you're exciting the brain in a particular way that it evokes a hearing response or a visual response. There are also some other studies that are trying to work with a part of the brain called the hippocampus, where you're trying to restore memories to those who have Alzheimer's, for example. And then even for epileptic patients, you may have abnormally firing neurons that you would like to send some information back to them to tell them to stop firing abnormally, and you may be able to achieve that through stimulation also. So yes, there's a huge area of neuroprosthetic research that's trying to bring back the sensory type of information and trying to send information back into the brain about what's occurring in the external world.
Can you use the same electrode?
So there are some technical challenges with using the same electrode, but there are examples out there that you can use the same electrode. I guess from a physiological point of view, you have to also ask, are the neurons that are sending control commands the same ones that you also want to send information back to? At least for the motor system, maybe you want to go to the sensory or somatosensory areas. It's not quite clear yet what are the exact locations through which we want to send this information back to the brain.
I guess not. You wouldn't want them to be the same. As you're saying, the areas that acquire information and the areas you want to stimulate would be different. So
yeah, possibly.
But right. You could have it on the same device, right? Where, you know, the same implant array, mm-hmm. You could array them at each one series A and series B, or, you know.
There's another aspect, at least along the lines of interacting with the same population of neurons, is let's say you could build some artificial firing neurons in silicon, and you could communicate with the neurons in your brain through a link to these artificial neurons that could possibly expand the computational aspects of the biological neurons. So that could be an instance where you would want to both stimulate and record from the same group of neurons.
How would you go about this? Would this be for patients that are disabled first and then move into an elective surgery format? Or do you see this? I mean, you see the success rate you have with the animals. How do you translate this into the final stage of brain interfaces? Where everybody would have one, just about.
The phase that we're at right now is we're really trying to prove the safety and efficacy of these types of devices. And from a regulatory point of view, these things are absolutely critical, right? From a patient's point of view, these aspects are absolutely critical. So once we go through the process of showing the benefits and the safety of all of this, then I think that it will start to open more possibilities for patients that are out there. So, of course, the first ones that are going to have these types of devices are the severely disabled, right? These are the ones that, you know, this is their option for regaining a high quality of life. But as the technology improves, as we see the benefits, then it's possible that it could expand outside of that realm. But to what extent, I think it remains a little bit unknown at this point.
I'd like to take a minute to thank GoToMeeting for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. Now, when taking on a new sponsor for a podcast, I think there's two criteria that I'd like to have met. And one, it'd be a product that I can endorse. And two, that the sponsor gives something back to the audience. Now, why would I be able to endorse GoToMeeting? Well, I think it's a great tool for the scientific community. Traditionally, when you have a meeting over the phone in a conference call, it's really hard to share that data. You have to formulate it in the form of a PowerPoint or a PDF document, or you print it out and mail it to them, and then you have to organize it in a way that's concise and simple and easy to communicate using these traditional means. If you could go online and share your desktop, you could really have a collaboration going on where you can analyze your raw data and work on it together and save a huge amount of time. You don't even have to leave your lab. So this I think is the number one reason why I think GoToMeeting is useful, and I can endorse it. Now, two, they give something back. There's a 30-day free trial. You can sign up. It takes just about 2 minutes. It's secure, and it works on both PCs and Macs. So if you have software that's specific for the Mac or the PC, or software that's specific to an instrument that you have in your lab and the other person doesn't have it, you can still work on that data together. If you've just done a video microscopy experiment and you have the codec, the video codec, and the other person doesn't have the video codec, it'll still work. They're giving a 30-day free trial with unlimited number of meetings. And if you want to give it a try, go to gotomeeting.com/biotech. Now, back to the interview.
So there's another aspect I don't know if you want to talk about that may be of interest to the tech side of the community listening. Yeah. You want to maybe go over that real fast?
There's no spin. No, don't rush.
Yeah. So let me tell you about this this new aspect that is really, it just came out. And this is one of the reasons that I sent you an email, because we had this huge press release behind the decoding aspect of neural interfaces. So we briefly discussed about how you have these computers that are interpreting a user's thought, right? They're deciphering the neural code in the brain. And again, they've all been working from the signal translator perspective. You have thoughts that are coming out. I translate them and I do something useful for you. The real change that we're trying to invoke here is that we're trying to build intelligence into the computers that are doing the decoding. So effectively, not only are you able to interact with a computer or prosthetic device with your thoughts, but that interface itself is assisting you. It's acting as an intelligent assistant that can help you to achieve your goals. So basically, the computer knows the goal, you know your goal, and it's going to do everything that it can to help you achieve that goal. So it's a transformative idea in terms of how we interact with the world.
So it doesn't have to be binary response. You can have a human type response, and then the computer says, "Well, that's human." If the algorithm fits within a framework, you can make a decision. I guess logic gate structure.
Right. Yeah. So we use a concept called reinforcement learning in this paradigm. So to put it in simple terms, if you create a neural activity that moves you closer to your goal, you're going to emphasize those types of behaviors and make them much stronger. And if you do the opposite, the same is true. You're going to weaken some of those connections. So both the computer knows what your goals are, you know what the goals are, and you're going to both choose strategies that enhance or reinforce these positive types of behaviors.
How about, you know, time shifting? Have you ever thought about the possibility of somebody performing a whole series of functions that could then be time shifted? I mean, you could store all the brain signaling. This is
yes,
great.
Yes, you could.
And then say, all right, go ahead. I'm walking. I'm going home. I've done my homework.
That's exactly right. If you know that neural activation, you can send that information to this intelligent type of device, and it can carry it out for you. And if you link back in the sensory type of aspect, you could be updated on how that progress is occurring. The other aspect of time shifting is you could potentially do it much faster. Right? Again, these communication channels and the speed of the processing of the hardware that we have today is so much greater than biological systems that you could potentially complete these tasks much faster.
And you refer biological systems as my hands on the steering wheel, or...
Yeah, it could be your muscles or the nerves that are stimulating your muscles, or that the pathway from your brain through your spinal cord to your muscles. These things typically are on the orders of let's say a couple hundred milliseconds.
Damn, biology.
But we right, biology, right? But we know that with, you know, sending electrical signals even over copper wire is much, much faster than that. So again, that's, you could, if you take the cumulative sum of all of these latencies, you could potentially do things much, much faster.
What a way to tap into the power of the human brain.
That's
the
right.
Untapped
That's right.
Aspects of the human brain.
Yeah, so
that's pretty wild.
A lot of the enabling aspects that are making this happen are the great advances in computers, both in just processor power and the ability to store huge amounts of data. I mean, we can easily store terabytes of data in a very short period of time if we record from hundreds of neurons. So, I mean, even 5 years ago,
it's cheap now.
That's what I was going to say here is that, you know, I can go down to your favorite computer hardware store and pick up a terabyte drive for, you know, $150. But even several years ago, this wasn't possible. So we had huge technology constraints on implementing some of these devices.
Are you, I suppose wireless would have been expensive 10 years ago when you were starting this kind of stuff. And now you could make a Bluetooth brain, right?
That's right. Low power wireless systems that have huge amounts of bandwidth. There are so many choices right now that, again, even 10 years ago, I would say 99% of the experiments that were ongoing were all wired.
Have you contacted FCC to potentially reserve a bandwidth for this wireless? I mean, I'd hate to see somebody walking down or somebody in a wheelchair who's trying to control his wheelchair.
Have some interference there.
Somebody with his Bluetooth mouse is sort of setting down.
Yeah, so
stairs.
There is some bandwidth that is reserved. It's a medical bandwidth, and this device that the team is working on here at UF, we're working within that bandwidth there. So the guy who's doing the telemetry side of this is working there.
All right.
So I don't think that there'll be any interference, at least in that band.
Right. Well, you know, there's pacemakers, not pacemakers, EKGs,
microwaves.
Yeah. I had a heart surgery a couple years back, and I had a wireless EKG that was sending signals. And I suppose if I was beaming to somebody who had an input device, I suppose we're pretty far away from the input devices and bandwidths per wavelength. Radio wavelength, it's getting incredible now. If you look over how cell phones, when they went first digital, how they sounded crappy, and now with 3G, we can send enormous amounts of data
on That's right.
very, very narrow bandwidth. So I think we're pretty cool. And the devices are so small. Have you seen the iFi card?
No, I haven't seen this card.
It's a little SD card, I think, that you just pop it in your camera and it sends it to your computer, your photos.
Oh, yeah. I have seen one of those. You know, way back in the early Palm days, I always wanted an SD card that had Wi-Fi on it, and I think now they're finally
coming
out.
Of course you did, right? Because the stuff you were working with was, you know, about 30 years in advance of the stuff
that's right.
computer technology. I mean, if you know, if we can send a signal, a brain signal wirelessly across the room, why can't we just send an image, a JPEG, right?
Right.
You guys are so way ahead of the game. I guess these two technologies, the two areas, information technology, and you're really at the interface of this, and you can borrow technology from one and they can borrow technology from you, and there's an exchange, the more it's catalyzed, right, and the transition to this these medical devices. Have you had any interest from industry? Is this privately funded at all, or is it mostly public right now? And I mean, it has a huge industry potential, but industry is very, very conservative.
That's right. So right now, the majority of the studies are federally funded from either the NIH, National Institute of Health, or National Science Foundation. But as these technologies become developed, we have patented a lot of the ideas, and we are currently seeking venture capital to spawn and spin some of these ideas off into some startup companies and hopefully move the technology into an environment where it could be advanced even much faster than it is now. So I think that both of these approaches are necessary to take this technology from a dream into a reality, right? You have these great ideas and high-risk types of projects that occur in the university system, and when they are shown, the proof of concept is shown, then we can move some of that out into industry where we can build the technology on a much more powerful scale and do that with tremendous types of resources. So I would really love to see both happen.
I think industry could give you the unlimited resources because the demand for a device like this would be so enormous that the money that could be generated from selling the device and developing it as a permanent, you know, chronic patient care that's associated with it, the economies are so large that the developments would just go through the roof. I mean, you'd have a staff of 500 rather than a staff of 5. Or, I don't know, 10, which is, you know, even in an academic lab, you know, 10 is a huge lab. So
right.
you develop collaborations and network. Mm-hmm. But this is a tremendous story. This is absolutely. Sure. We're going to have you back as you, you know, move this technology forward, because this is just, it's really, really wild. This is the IT of the biological world here.
One thing that I think is really nice about this technology is that it really started off as a dream, and even as a science fiction type of dream, that you interface devices directly with the brain and you build this prosthetic or bionic type of device. And it's tremendous that we are seeing it realized in our everyday life now. So I think that it makes the future very bright for this area of technology, and extremely excited to be a part of it.
I think Leo is going to be Leo and Scott Bourne are going to be the first adopters of the elective surgery. Right? These guys,
sign me up, right? You know, I always listen to these guys on the Twitch show also, and they go off. You know, some new product or something will come out, and you hear Leo say, "Sign me up, that's what I want."
we'll know that it's really. A common household device when it gets onto the daily gizmos.
That's right. I would be interested to hear what Dvorak would say about this. Oh, these guys are crazy. Oh, no, they're doing great things. Who knows what he would say?
Keyboard's the way to go.
That's right.
Well, he's a great guy. Actually, so, his commentary. He's very insightful. And
he is.
He would be a good guy to have on your board of directors when you when you translate.
That's right. That's right.
Of course, a whole new form of GUI, right? Our keyboard is 100 years old, and our mouse is whatnot. Competing technologies? Just before we go, are there competing technologies other than inserting electrodes? Can this be done with other forms
EEG
of
neuroimaging,
MRIs?
Yeah, so MRI, fMRI, there is some small evidence that you can use that modality, but it's typically very slow compared to electrophysiology, so it may not be suitable for motor types of tasks. There's evidence that you can use the electroencephalogram that you just place upon the scalp of the user, but there are some issues there with resolution also, and both in time and in space. So there's some more tech development that needs to happen in order to really make these things feasible for everyday life.
I guess in terms of fashion statement as well, I'd rather have your device than have a really weird-looking cat.
Right. That's right.
Helmet head, right. Helmet hair. All right. I'll definitely let you go. That. Thank you very much for coming on.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Before I get to the traditional thank yous of the show, I'd just like to send a quick shout out to Leo and Scott. Both Justin and I are huge fans of your shows, This Week in Tech, MacBreak Weekly, This Week in Photography. What I think is really important here is that you guys have an incredible enthusiasm for technology, and that enthusiasm that you have is infectious. This is really important moving the frontier of science forward, so please keep up that enthusiasm. So I'd really like to thank Dr. Justin Sanchez, director of the Neuroprosthetics Research Group at the University of Florida, for sharing his scientific story today. I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the great opening and closing themes. Lastly, I'd like to thank the kind folks at Pods in Print for providing the transcripts to today's show. They're available at futuresinbiotech.com. Now, I must mention that producing transcripts with this high level of accuracy that these guys do in a field as specialized as biotech is really tough. So if you want to get some transcripts done, you can contact Tom Price at Pods and Print. So that's tom.price@podsandprint.com. And he will make sure that they get done by the right editor who's familiar with the topic of the transcript. He goes out and gets these editors from top 10 UK universities. So they're as accurate as you can possibly get, and we really appreciate them. So that's it. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.